Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to the Fighting on Film podcast, the podcast all about classic and obscure war movies, from the Normandy landings to the days of chivalry and swords. If it's been captured on film, we're going to try and cover it. I'm Robbie of RN Military History.
I'm Matthew Moss of Historical Firearms and the Armourer's Bench. Hello there, sorry to interrupt. I wanted to let you know that you can now join our supporting cast over on Patreon. As thanks for your support, you'll be able to help us pick films, submit questions for guests, have first pick on brand new and exclusive merch, and much more. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
Hello, welcome to Fighting on Film. Today we have a very special guest with us. It's none other than the legendary Dale Dye, founder of Warriors Inc., who's revolutionised the way that war movies are made. From Platoon to Saving Private Ryan, Dale has worked on some of the genre's biggest films, and we are delighted to have you with us. Dale, welcome to the show.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say. So, Patreon questions. Would you want to start?
Yeah, let's dive straight in. So, John Forsyth has the first question. He said, did Mr. Dye have a gut feeling of Band of Brothers was going to be something special, and how good was Luz at doing impressions of him?
Okay, let me see if I could get right at this. Look, I knew simply because I was familiar with the book, the original material, and when you're talking Spielberg and Hanks, you know that it's going to be a quality thing. I was fairly sure that we were going to do something special. How special it was going to be, I really got a feeling for once I began to train the troops and meet these young actors that were portraying actual characters. At that point, I knew if I didn't screw it up and if I imbued them with the right spirit and the right understanding of the story, that it definitely was going to be something special. Now, that said, I did not have any idea of the lasting impact. I thought, sure, it's going to be something really special, and you know, war movie geeks like us are going to absolutely love it. But I didn't really understand at the time the life that it would have, and it's had an extraordinary life. I mean, it. Look, I still stand in grocery store lines, and somebody in the line will do some of my dialogue as Colonel Sink, you know, from the show. So, you know, I have to have you all shot, that sort of thing. So while I knew we were onto something special, I didn't really understand the life that it was going to have, the legs that it was going to have, even to this day. Now, the second part of your question is, which one of those little maggots could imitate me best? I say it was a toss-up. Bull Rentelman, Mike Cudlitz could do it really well. And there were a few others who snuck in imitations. Every time I'd turn my back, I'd hear myself doing something. But it was all in great good humor and spirit. And it just, to me, it just showed me what tremendous talent these kids had.
It's one of the, like, the eternal things of the series is it's just cast so well, and it's that's part of its timelessness. Yeah. Amazing. So our second question for you today comes from Ken Campbell, and he asks, what type of advising does one do for a CGI film like Sergeant Stubby and American Hero, and to a lesser extent, Small Soldiers?
It's more difficult. Look, I've spent most of my life raising other people's children and training young soldiers. So mm-hmm. I want to deal with human beings and look in their BDS eyeballs and try to influence their behavior. But when you're doing CGI, it's a whole new world, computer generated imagery. What happens is you find yourself having to react or plan or stage with something that isn't really there. Mm. And it takes, you have to stretch your imagination and sometimes I'll have to work with the actors to say, now look, you can't see it, but this is happening. Now, they've gone huge strides in advancing CGI. I just finished working over in UK last year for almost a year on one of the most extraordinary CGI events I've ever seen, and it's the Masters of the Air 8 Air Force, which is a follow-on to Band of Brothers and then the Pacific and now Masters of the Air or Whirlwind or whatever it's going to be called. And that was just fraught with CGI. I mean, every time we turned around, we had to imagine something going on. So it's a bigger acting challenge, and in many cases, a bigger staging challenge, because you've always got to be aware that that green screen or that rear screen projection or whatever it is in the picture. Mm. So it's a difficulty, but you learn to live with it. And the reason you learn to live with it is because of the extraordinary results that you get, the imagery that you get.
I mean, we mentioned Masters of the Air there, and obviously you've had a long working partnership with Tom Hanks and the crew behind Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers, and then onwards through Pacific and now Masters of the Air. Without giving any spoilers, on set, did you get the impression that it's going to be, you know, another one of those seminal pieces of, you know, filmmaking where it's like, wow, this is real, this is amazing storytelling, telling the story of these men? Did you get that impression?
I hope so. I hope so. Look, it's always a crapshoot when you do these things, how the dice are going to roll and how audiences are going to accept it and so on and so forth. Unlike Band of Brothers in the Pacific, which were an HBO production here in the States, this one is for Apple Plus, and that's a subscription streamer here in the States. And you know, I don't know what that's going to do to the audience. I do know that it's full of real eye popping stuff. I mean, I'm still under a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't tell you a great deal, but I can say that it's going to be an eye popper if you're willing to find it.
I think it's going to be everywhere, isn't it? So I know that everyone that listens to our show is highly anticipating it when it releases. And
yeah,
you know, we've seen little bits in, I think, Apple trailers that came out earlier this year and it gave us a little taste.
Yeah.
So we are excited for it.
They're testing the waters, I know. Mm. But look, I can say this. It's probably the most expensive thing I've ever worked on.
Wow.
And it had some of the most amazing technology I've ever seen. And, you know, there were very few things that we, you know, money didn't seem to be a big object. We built stuff and created stuff that, in my view, were just staggering what it was going to be. Now, that said, I've only seen bits and pieces, just as you have. And a lot depends on the cutting. I mean, we may have spent a lot of money on certain scenes up on the cutting room floor. I don't know. But I think I'm I anticipate that it's going to be a big deal.
Well, that's great. We look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, can't wait.
Yeah, I think we all are.
Yeah.
Moving on to a bit more of a general question now from Samuel Foster. He asks, out of all the actors that you've advised and worked with over the years, who did you think had the best soldiering skills?
You know, I've trained
That's
so many
question.
Of them. I think, yeah, it's a hard question. There's probably got to be around 800 that we've trained over the years. I have to say that some of them were really terrific. Tom Berenger, who was great with us in platoon, would have made a great platoon sergeant in real life. Damian Lewis absolutely understood an officer's role and leadership. He was terrific. You know, there have been the Tom Hanks is just, you know, he's every man, and he knows. He has that kind of technological mind, and he's interested in things, which I think shows in his performance and in his creation of characters on screen. Let me just say in general terms that I've probably seen more good ones than I've seen bad ones.
Yeah. Do you think that's down to just actors being able to be malleable? That's because that's their job. Like, they're willing to learn rather than...
Yeah, and interested. And understand beyond the imagery. So many actors you find are interested in how does my hair look and am I wearing a uniform right and how many lines do I have in this scene. The really good ones that I've trained think way beyond that. You know, they're trying to understand what it is to lead, what it is to face fear in extremis and that sort of thing. And when they go to that depth, you're almost guaranteed to get great performances from them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I guess my job is to make sure they go to that depth.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. I think the next question leads in beautifully from that answer. It's from Andrew Caesar Gordon. And he says, what do you consider to be the most important elements of an actor's boot camp?
Look, I think it's this. I think it is compelling an understanding that there is something more important in life than yourself. Understanding self-sacrifice and devotion to a larger mission and an image. If I had to write it large, I would say that's it. Because that's foreign to so many young men in today. You know, it's all about me, me, me. Well, it's not when you're in the military. It's about the guy next to you and his reliance on you and your reliance on him. So getting to that point is a major issue. If I can get there with them, then everything else makes sense.
This is another interesting question from Andrew. And he asks, what examples come to mind of where directors didn't take your advice about what was realistic to portray on screen? And why do you think that they decided not to follow that advice?
Well, there have been a number of instances where I've suggested some things and directors absolutely just ignored it. And look, I'm a pretty expensive element to have on the set. So they tend to listen to me more than they don't listen to me.
Yeah.
And good directors are interested in telling a story from the basis of reality. So they want to start there. But I've seen enormous departures and things that just make me cringe. And I'm sitting there and saying, you know, I told you that why are you doing this? And the answer generally comes in, I guess, what you'd call dramatic license. Yeah. The director has the whole story in mind, not just details. And sometimes he'll think, well, I could do what Dale tells me. But in my view, that would carve out from the dramatic impact of the thing. Now, I find that not to be necessarily the case. Look, my position essentially is this, guys. In combat or in general military situations, the reality is often much, much more dramatic than anything a writer is going to dream up. And so if you just go there, you're in pretty good shape. I guess though, to answer specific questions, I have certain things that always bug me. One of them is, how a man acts when he gets hit, whether it's by shrapnel or bullets and all that sort of thing. I've been hit a couple of times and I kind of know the inside story of that. But there's a tendency to have the actors or the stuntmen that are working in a scene do this funky chicken dance when rounds hit them and all that stuff. And that's so far from the truth. The truth is that when you're hit lethally, generally you just collapse like a puppet. It's like a puppet and somebody cut the strings and down you go. Mm. And to me, that's much more dramatic than doing some kind of dance just to juice the impact of rounds on a human body. So that's one of the things that I often worry about. It's only a small thing, but it's huge in my view. I hope that answers the question.
No, that's great.
It does. I mean, would you say that is one of the things that made you want to get into the business and, have a positive impact?
I think so, yeah. Look, one of the things that made me, I was really ignorant about how movies are made and how advice is taken and given and so on and so forth. But I think the truth of the matter is that what I was seeing in military movies prior to my coming on the scene and making some kind of success with it, what I was seeing just pissed me off. I mean, it was ridiculous, some of this stuff. And I said, who the hell isn't somebody talking to these people and making them try to understand not to do these horrible gaffes that you see all the time? And so that prompted me. I said, well, look, it's true that when you're ignorant, you can do a lot of things that people tell you you can't do. And certainly that was my case. So I said, I'm going to go out there and unscrew these guys. They're screwed up. I'm going to unscrew them and tell them how to do this. Well, it was hardly that easy, but I made it work. And I think for the better. It certainly, now I can't even remember what the question was.
Yeah, is that what made you want to get into actually advising?
Yes, it did. Is the short answer?
Yeah, I mean, I think this question might flow into that as well. Thomas McCall asks, and obviously, it's as much as you'd like to share. He says, "What impact has your own military service in Vietnam had on your approach to acting, advising actors on projects?"
Oh, it has. It's pivotal. It's seminal.
Of course.
Opened the door to what reality is and how human beings behave in extremis. Mm. So absolutely, it had a huge impact. And from a practical standpoint, it's the reason I was able to do what I was able to do with Platoon, which I think was a launching pad for my career. So it was absolutely a seminal experience. The experience I had in Vietnam and in the Middle East in Beirut, all of them open doors, and because I'm a natural born dyed in the wool storyteller, I'm an observer and I see these things and these things impact and stay with me in my memory, and there's a sensory memory that's involved, and it's not just observing scenes, although that's valuable, but it's understanding the emotions involved and understanding the senses involved and how, how things smell as well as how they look and how things sound as well as how they look. And I've always been a huge observer of that. I'm like a sponge about those things. I pick them up and I remember them. And that has all been part and parcel of what we've done with Warriors Incorporated in training actors and in staging military films.
Yeah. So it must have been quite liberating and useful to find Oliver Stone as a director for Platoon and having that shared experience. Do you think that it wouldn't have been the film it was and if you hadn't been able to have that shared experience?
Yeah, absolutely. It wouldn't have been the film it was. But Oliver and I were simpatico. I mean, we were kindred spirits in that regard. we didn't agree on everything because his experience in Vietnam was somewhat different than mine so on. But generally, and especially in the detail stuff, which he couldn't remember, and I certainly could. So I would fill in those blanks. And we got to the point, I think, where, we were doing sort of nonverbal communication. So I'd look at him, he'd look at me, and suddenly he'd say, yeah, I understand. And we'd go off and do this. And he was very happy with what I was able to do with the 33 actors that he gave me to train and the 3 weeks that he gave me to take them into the jungles in the Philippines. He admired that. And he said that that it would not have been the performances that the actors gave would not have been what they were had they not been introduced to the environment and the emotions and the senses and all that sort of thing that I was able to give them.
Yeah, it definitely shows. It's one of the, highly requested movie on the show, and everyone always mentions it when we talk Vietnam films. You can't not have a conversation without mentioning Platoon.
Yeah, it was my start as an actor.
Of course.
It was the last damn thing on my mind, but but Oliver had seen me training. And he said, well, geez, the guy's he's a company commander. Why don't I just cast him as a company commander? And I was reluctant at first. Yeah. But he convinced me, and some of the young actors said, Captain, you've trained us, and we respond to you, and just go in there and do what you do. And essentially, that's what I did. The fortunate thing was the critics noticed, and that kind of launched a little career for me. But. Mm.
Is acting something that you ever considered when you started working in Hollywood? Is it something that had ever occurred to you, or had it always been just clearly focused on trying to do that advisory role?
Certainly I was focused on the advisory role when I started, but as I began to observe certain actors.
Being around actors and interacting with them, that sort of thing.
I said, I can do that. I mean, if you look at it in practical terms, the professional military, whether it's in the UK, in France, in America, wherever it is, the professional military is probably one of the finest training grounds for young actors that you can get. Just think about it this way. You have to perform in certain roles as a professional soldier, whether you're actually that person or not. You've got to give that persona. You've got to adopt that persona. And that's essentially what acting is.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. It really is. You're a tool almost, aren't you? You're told to do something and you have to go and do it. Pick up a
research
paycheck.
Research it, study it, and decide what that should be. Mm. There you go.
Mm. Yeah.
I think one of the most interesting things with war movies before the 60s is you had all of those guys that had served, and their service informed how they acted in war movies within the war movie genre. So if they needed to be an airman, they could be an airman. If they needed to be a Marine, they had an idea of what was needed, how to present themselves, how to handle themselves. So I think what fundamentally changed is, as those actors became tall for roles and time went on, and a new generation of young actors that had never served and had no idea, the importance of what you came to do in the industry when you did compensated for that lack of experience, that military experience within like the cadre of actors.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly 100%. When we think of the seminal war movies of our young lives, most of them were done by guys that had some military experience. They either fought in World War II or Korea or at least served in the military because America had a draft. And so they brought that sort of insight with them. But we reached a period, probably during and after Vietnam, in which nobody had that experience. Nobody was active and was eligible for lead roles in films and that sort of thing, young enough to play those roles, had any military experience whatsoever. And it became painfully obvious to me. I assumed going in that these guys would understand certain things. And of course, what they understood was the last bad war movie they saw. And so there was a tendency to emulate that. So it was a fight. Sometimes that the fight was to get all of the preconceived crapola out of their minds and start over from square one. That was a bit of a fight in some cases. But you're exactly right. We hit a period where the leading men, if you will, are the really good character actors who played military, played parts in military movies, were just too old to be that young soldier again. So they became the colonel and the general who waves big hands on small maps and that sort of thing. And the young men who came up, the young leading men who came up to fulfill those roles had no experience whatsoever. So, yeah, I recognized that, and I knew that that was something I would have to help fulfill some way.
Mm. That's incredible. So next question is, have you ever, Brian Williams asks, have you ever had to tell a director that soldiers wouldn't behave in a certain way? I'm sure you have.
Yes, practically every day, every scene, every hour. But the neat thing, so the direct answer to the question is, yes, I've had to do that a lot. But the direct answer to your question is, if I have been given the time to train a unit of young actors, they police themselves. A director will say, okay, we're going to do this. And he'd say, no, I wouldn't do that. I've been trained not to do that. And that sometimes leaves the director with kind of egg on his face, and I have to go in and settle that. But in general, if you train them right, they'll police themselves. They won't allow themselves to do stupid things.
That's fascinating.
Wow. Yeah. So well drilled that they'll just.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Wow. So next question, Paul Hicks asks, is there a period of history that you would like to build an immersive boot camp for that is far removed from any 20th century setting that you've done so far?
Look, I've done some really interesting stuff. I did Alexander with Oliver Stone, which was, you know, 20th century, or it was before the Common Era.
Ancient
history. That was fun, but it's hard to research that stuff. I mean, you find yourself looking at Grecian urns and, you know, trying to figure out how to this one. That was fun, and I did 1757, the French and Indian War in Last of the Mohicans. That was tremendous fun. I was able to train British and British infantry, that was good. I don't know. There's probably we've just had some really terrific. I always thought the answer to your question would be I would love to research and set up a training for World War I, but that's kind of been OBE now, overcome by events, because of the great success of All Quiet on the Western Front. And 1917 were terrific films. I had quibbles with each of them, but that's to be expected because I didn't.
We all do. I mean, that's the thing with you know, moviegoers and war movie buffs. We all have things where we go, that's not how I do it, or that's not quite right.
Do you find there's much? I don't want to say rivalry, might be the wrong word, but do you find you have like a sort of. Do the big military advisors come together and you have a chat and you go, oh, well, I've done that and I wouldn't have done that. Do you have moments like that?
I wish that were the case, but there are so damn few of us. I mean, I think there are two that I know of, me and another guy. Everybody else seems to be called in as an advisory role on a specific project and you never see them again. It would be wonderful if there was a set of professional military advisors out there, but there isn't. I mean, we set the bar and then broke the mold for the most part. Mm. I still get hundreds of notes and papers from people who want to be me and figure out how to do it. But that's I don't know the answer to that question.
No. Yeah, it's amazing.
So we mentioned We mentioned the Last of the Mohicans and Alexander. So when you're doing films that are set in a period which is, you know, far and away from your own military experience and the general experience of 20th century military conflict, etc., how do you approach that as an advisor? You know, decide on what's needed to make it feel militarily authentic?
Yeah, look, one of the things that people don't understand about what I do is what a scholar you have to be. I mean, what a in-depth, efficient researcher you have to be, where you have to go for materials. And it, as you point out, it's not so much superficial. I mean, you can read Wikipedia, you know, and find out what the elements of a particular historical battle were. But that's not what we're after here. We're after, you know, what were the problems? How did the shoes hold up? You know, how did it smell? How were animals treated? And you get so in depth, and there's a lot of rabbit holes you could run down in research. You have to, and I'm that guy. You know, I love to run down those rabbit holes and find out these minutiae. But you have to be able to say, okay, that's useful, that's interesting, but not useful, and get on with it.
I bet that's tricky sometimes.
Yeah, it is. And what I find, what the interesting part to me was, it used to be that you could get away with certain egregious errors before the age of the internet, if you will. Movie fans, especially war movie fans these days, you don't get that slack. They're coming right after you.
We know.
I guess you do. Yeah. I find myself being a little more careful. I don't say that's good enough. I go and do the research and find out what the specifics of that thing are. And as you point out, if you're dealing with ancient history, I remember when we were doing The Last of the Mohicans, I was fortunately able to get over into Lambeth Road into the Imperial War Museum. And do some research and found out, you know, the 13 steps of loading and firing a Brown Vest. And that's, those things are very specific. And I incorporate them in the training. And I think that was to the betterment.
Mm. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, we often talk about this on the show. There's a balance between things are perfectly historically correct and things make a historically authentic movie. There's a balance there. And, you know, some things can be forgiven if the rest of the film works as a film and it also feels authentic.
Yeah, look, it's the difference. And boy, you know it and I know it. It's the difference between a documentary and a dramatic theatrical presentation.
Exactly. You want it to be entertaining. Yeah.
I mean, we're the only guys who probably watch those documentaries. But at any rate, they're out there.
Yeah. And films are entertainment at the base level, aren't they? Yeah. So there's this whole Venn diagram of what do you use, what do you not? And you're still trying to make it entertaining. And I think that's what makes a very good war movie. If you can hit all three, you're doing well.
I'll just say this and then go on to another subject. What you can't do is cater to the geeks. I call them the stitch knife.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Nazis. These are the guys who worry about the color of the thread on a patch or a button or something like that. I really love them. And they're the guys who will pay money to see the film over and over and over and wear out the pause button on their remote. I know those guys, and I'm probably talking to a couple of them. But
we've all got it in there somewhere, I think.
Yeah, but you can't when you're doing the whole film and you have to look at how the whole story is being told. There's sometimes you just have to say, hey, look, this is going to piss Wee Willie Winky off, but I got to go here. I got to do this, and off you go. That's an observation.
No, of course. It's we have a segment in the show where we dedicate like 20 minutes to talking about the kit, the uniforms, tactics, things like that. But then we're off that subject and we go into, you know, scenes, our favorite scenes, and we actually, you know, critique the movie as a movie, but we leave the stitch Nazi-ing, the rivet counting in the section so we can have our gripes and then leave it, because you could just have a whole episode or a whole critique of a film could be based on a jacket, and it doesn't help anybody.
It would be painful. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the next question comes from AD Bond. He asks, which do you prefer being technical advisor on, a Vietnam War movie or a World War II movie?
I suppose I would have to say I prefer working on World War II movies. The literature is so rich and so in-depth. If I'm going to go someplace, I want to go there. But if Vietnam is very personal to me. If a good opportunity comes up to work on a Vietnam film, I mean, I'll take it. I write books and they're, I vacillate between whether I want to talk about Vietnam or whether I want to talk about World War II. For my generation of Americans, and I'm a little older than you guys are, but for my generation, they're both seminal events in world history. And so I'm kind of open to both of them, but I probably want to do a World War II, and for a couple of reasons. The primary one is it's a simple story. You know who the bad guys are. The bad guys are Japanese bad guys, or German bad guys, Nazi bad guys, or fascisti Italian bad guys. And that's pretty well it. It's black and white. Everybody else is a good guy. So it's a little easier storytelling.
Mm. Yeah, 100%. Vietnam can be quite muddled.
Yeah, right.
Definitely. Matt, next question.
Yeah, one from me. I mean, we spoke about it a little bit earlier. As an actor, do you have a favorite scene that stands out to you that you've been in? So you know, all those great scenes from Band of Brothers, you've got the great scenes from Platoon, you've got that amazing sequence with Michael J. Fox in Casualties of War, where you kind of trying to quash the, you know, his request for an investigation. That scene's incredible to me. I watched it again the other day. I mean, do any of those stand out to you? What was your favorite?
It's hard to call a favorite, and that's because I haven't done that much. I mean, I've done a respectable amount of work as an actor on screen, but I'm probably the most typecast guy in Hollywood. I mean, let's bring me Dale Dye or somebody who acts like Dale Dye. You know, it's that sort of thing. So I don't get to stretch much. And I'm always the guy who enters scene one and tells you what the mission is. Mm. And then I come back in scene three and say, congratulations, well done, here's a medal. You know what I mean? That's kind of what I do. And I wish I would had an opportunity to do more stuff. But I guess that scene in Casualties of War with Michael Fox, I'm fairly proud of that.
Mm.
I'm certainly proud of what I did with Colonel Sink in Band of Brothers. And the interesting thing is his family, Colonel Sink's family, General Sink, was very happy with it too. I was delighted to hear that.
Wow, that's really cool.
I also did a movie. I don't know if you've seen it in the UK, but there was a movie that I did several years ago called Rough Riders, and it was about.
Oh, I love that film.
Matt loves it.
I do. I love that. Well, it's a miniseries, isn't it? But I love that. It's so great.
Yeah, I was really happy to play General Leonard Wood in that one, and with my friend Tom Berenger, who was doing Roosevelt at the time. So
yeah.
So I guess when I get an opportunity and get my teeth into it, every time that I've been given that opportunity, it stands out as a real highlight to me.
Yeah, for me, it's when you voiced Gunny Loughton in Medal of Honor Rising Sun. It's one of my most favorite games from my childhood, and it's amazing to be hearing him live. It's amazing.
Yeah, and the voice and the ability to spew military jargon in the proper way has gotten me a lot of voice work.
Yes.
In video games and that sort of thing. So it's really hard to pick out one. They've all been of a type, with a few exceptions. I've done a couple of little comedies and that sort of thing. And I love to do comedy. But nobody thinks, you know, a guy like me could ever be funny or have a sense of humor. So that's out. But
it's a shame.
Their loss.
Yeah,
I think it is their loss. Yeah.
I guess it's hard to answer your question directly. I've enjoyed everything I've done.
I mean, obviously you should, as you should. So the next question is going to be a bit of a mean one then. JVD asks, which of Dell's movie projects are you most proud of having been part of?
Adult movie projects?
Oh, sorry, no. Which of Dale's movie projects? Sorry, might be my mumbling my words there. Sorry.
I think that might have been a connection issue there.
We'll cut that there. I'll go again. Which of your movie projects are you most proud of? If you can.
It probably would go to Platoon because that launched my career. It gave me an opportunity to show what a good advisor can do and what a good advisor should be. But I'm also very proud of all of the miniseries. Band of Brothers is just superlative. We set the bar so high, I don't know if we can ever reach it again. And I think The Pacific is underrated. I think we made a few mistakes in telling those stories, but it's one of my favorites because it involves Marines.
Of course.
And I guess, you know, without having to run through the entire resume, I'd probably say those three stack up around the top.
Yeah. Yeah. I adore The Pacific. I think it's almost the antithesis of Band of Brothers, where it really gets into the nitty gritty. It really explores the psyche of the effect of men in war. I say a lot on the show that Band of Brothers for me is men in war, but Pacific is effect of war on men. It's a different beast.
It's a clean, relatively speaking, the European theater was a clean war, as opposed to the dirt and grime and you know the tyranny of geography of the Pacific. It was a different deal, and we intended that. We intended it to be the antithesis of what you were seeing in Band of Brothers.
Yeah. Oh no, I think he achieved it. So it's one I go back to a lot. Just because I love it, but also Band of Brothers as well. Matt, next one.
We mentioned it a little bit earlier about your work in video games and the Medal of Honor series and Battlefield 2 as well. What do you have to bring to that when you're asked to A, do voice work on it or advise militarily? It's obviously such a different thing to going into the field and training actors to be soldiers, Marines, whatever. Whereas when you come to a video game, you've got to present a package of information to a production team that has to put these sort of things together.
Well, I don't have that much experience with it, but I've had experience with some pretty high profile stuff.
Absolutely.
And my approach was to go in and look and see who these guys are. Who are the designers? Who are the engineers? Who are the writers? And that sort of thing. And then say, all right, guys, look, people have you locked in behind a computer screen and a keyboard and that sort of thing. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to police all of you up and put you in my truck, and we're going to go out and we're going to shoot weapons.
One day out with Dale, yeah.
Live ammunition, and I want you to feel recoil. And the geeks loved it. I mean, you know, the absolute nerds that are the computer designers and things, nobody had ever offered them that. And I took them out and said, here you go. And I want you to understand these things.
Give them a feel.
And then
for
as
them.
I did that, what it prompted was this raft of questions from the designers and from the engineers and that sort of thing. And I think that improved the play of the deal, of the game. There are certain limitations, and you have to understand that you're playing a video game. For instance, my big problem in the days when we were beginning Medal of Honor and that sort of thing was, look, a lot of fighting goes on at night. Oh, yeah, but you can't see anything. And I said, well, you know, and how about mud? How about rain? How about weather? That's an infantryman's nightmare. And the guys got it. They understood it. But that was difficult at that stage of technology to create that sort of. Now they've done it.
Yes.
And I think it's much better. But I guess the voice work, what I was after was they had played a couple of video games for me so I could get familiar, because I honestly had never seen one except Steven Spielberg, who played them constantly while we were doing Saving Private Ryan.
Oh, really?
But, right.
Yeah. In fact, wow. That's how I got drafted into the whole thing. But the deal was that they played a couple of things for me, and I listened to the voices. And I said, who are these idiots? I mean, they have no idea what they're saying. You know, they use some acronym and mispronounce it, and they certainly don't know how to give a command or how to give a briefing. And I do. That's my meat and potatoes. I grew up doing that sort of thing. So I would say, okay, look, when you get ready to do these characters, call me. I'll come in and I'll be the voice and do it right. And I think I did, because from what I've heard, they stand head and shoulders above what I'd heard previously.
They do. Those Medal of Honor games, they were unlike anything else when they arrived, because there'd been nothing like them before. So, yeah.
Definitely. It's like playing a movie, wasn't it? I remember.
Yeah, it was. It was a real experience. It was immersive for the time, you know, with the technology.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, no, massively. Very formative game. A final Patreon question. It's from Peter Ladner, and he asks, if you had to put together a squad of actors to carry out a Men on a Mission task, like Saving Private Ryan, who would you choose and what actor would you want as your second in command? Put you on the spot there.
I guess the answer is my second in command has been with me for 50 years, Mike Stokey. He and I were young corporals together in Vietnam, and I drafted him into my scheme of maneuver. So he would certainly be my executive officer because he's a Captain Die clone. He knows exactly what to do, and I don't have to issue orders, and he does it. Plus the fact that when we get really busy, he runs his own team, and he can do a film independently while I'm working on another film. And what was it? Give me the context of the question again, so I make sure I answer it.
So if you had to do like a squad of actors for a Men on a Mission type movie, who would you choose? Like what actors are your go-to actors?
What actors? Okay. I was really impressed with Tom Cruise. When we were doing Born on the 4th of July, that guy's got heart. I mean, he doesn't settle for second best. So he'd probably be in the squad leader area.
Okay.
I think Tom Berenger would certainly be a fire team leader, if not the squad leader. I would take several of the guys from Band of Brothers, Michael Cudlitz, Bull Randleman, I don't know if I could get him to do it, but, I'd take Damien along with me. There's just a bunch of them. I was impressed with, I did a couple of movies with a young actor named Don Harvey. We did The Beast and Mission of the Shark, and he's good. It's really difficult to, I'd have to run down a cast list.
Yeah, of course.
Fantasy football always is tricky, though.
And that's a great little fire team that you've put together, though.
Those guys would be knockouts.
I bet they would. But here's a question from me. So what's the most challenging aspect of your job? Like, I know you know it, you've done it for many years now, but what, when you're on a set, what do you find the most challenging things?
The older I get, the most challenging thing is keeping up and outrunning those little 18-year-old kid birds.
Of course.
I'm almost 80 now, and it's physically more demanding than I remember or it ever seemed to me before. But I guess it is the relationship that I have with the director. Most of the time, it's hand in glove. I mean, he looks at me and says, what do you think? And you can't ask for a better, and if I say, look, we blew it, let's take two and off we go. So establishing that relationship with the director, and if they're smart, prior to that with the writers, to get this stuff right so we don't waste time once we're filming. That's a difficult thing. And then the business of being everybody's source of information. It can really pull you apart. I mean, the props guys want to know everything. The uniform guys want to know everything. The set dressers and designers want to know everything. And the armorer wants to know everything. And you're pulled a lot of ways, which is why I always try to bring my executive officer and one of my NCOs along with me. That's expensive for an advisory staff. But the point is, I can cover all bases and get everybody's questions answered. So I guess establishing your position in the overall production. Sometimes you have to fight for that position because people are suspicious of you. You know, oh, this guy is trying to make his own movie, not my movie, and that's not the case at all. I'm just trying to guide you. So sometimes building credibility and credence when you're on the set. And understanding that you're not the guy who's always says no, you're the guy who says no, but, and offer a better way of doing it that still accomplishes the dramatic task of the directors after. Those are the tough things. With some directors, especially ones you've worked with before, it's easier. It's old home week. You know, the old boys club is back together. With some ones, new ones who are a little, not so self-confident and who are worried about, you know, giving up any authority or any power to anybody else, then it gets tough. But the good news for me is that we have such a track record out there that people tend to say, okay, all right, if that's what he says, let's do it that way. So it's become easier as you get more experience and get more accolades on the resume.
Of course, of course. I guess we can't not ask you this. We ask every guest. Personally, what's one of your favorite war movies to watch?
I bet you don't know this one.
Ooh, maybe. Okay.
All right. It's a little thing called Steel Helmet.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. 1950, it was made in the 60s, but it's about Korea in the 1950s. Yes. And you talk about a tour de force for an actor. Gene Evans, who plays the sergeant in that thing, is absolutely, for that movie genre, he's George Scott and Pat. I mean, it's just absolutely perfect. And he's such a curmudgeon, and I've known guys like that and been trained by guys like that. So that's one of my favorites. I saw it not long ago. It was a Memorial Day here in the States, and they show all of my movies all day, wall to wall. So I was able to see it again, and I just appreciate it. That film was made for $250,000 all in. Yeah, wow. And there are some, some technical quibbles, but, it was done by Sam Fuller, who was himself a combat veteran. So
yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, that's great. So leading on from that, I guess, is there a movie from that era or from your like film movie, you know, viewing past that you'd love to see remade if you could work on it as an advisor? What war movie would you remake?
I would love to do the ones I really like don't need to be remade.
Of course, well, yeah, I mean, of course. Yeah.
Don't fix it if it ain't broke.
Very true.
I mean, I love The Bridges at Toko Rhee. I love The Bridge on the River Kwai. And those films were so terrific that I'd be aghast if somebody really wanted to try to remake that. How do you fix perfect? My wife often tells me is that the enemy of good is perfect, you know. Right. So don't screw with it if it works. Yeah. I don't know how to answer the question.
No, that's fine. That's fine.
That's a great answer. I kind of tangentially on that. You obviously got your big break working on Platoon with Oliver Stone. What was it like getting the call from Ben Stiller about Tropic Thunder, which, if I'm right, in some of the interviews that you've talked about and stuff he's talked about in the past, he kind of picked your brains around that production of the training and that sort of thing, and really fueled the film.
And I think Ben Stiller had my character, me personally, in mind when he was doing that, when he was writing that thing. But he was very gracious and very nice, and he said, "Look, it's a comedy." And I said, "Yeah, I get it. I've read what you've done. I love comedy. So I spoof it. Let's go." You know. So he did. Yeah, he picked my brains about a bunch of things. And then I went down and worked with Nick Nolte, and he picked my brains about a bunch of other things. And I loved the film. Now, unfortunately, I was not able to be there personally. In my executive officer, Mike Stokey, went and did it. Mm. But they got the full Warriors treatment.
Yeah.
And when I saw it, I was just, I mean, I had worked with Robert Downey Jr. before. And I knew what a loon he could be. And he was. So it just tickled my comedy sense tremendously. I love the film, and I think Ben did a great job with it.
Yeah, we love it here. It's very, very funny. And I know we're running out of time, but I have to ask you this before we wrap up. Rewatched Red Dawn recently. I watched the special features, and it had an interview with you. And I don't think you went into detail on the interview, but I'd love to hear the tale. Apparently you had Charlie Sheen in the Wolverines as a op for the National Guard at one point during the training.
Yeah, I don't remember a whole lot about that. But
right.
Charlie was always an interesting case. You hit with him, you have to be sure he's telling you not telling you what you want to hear and believing something else. Because he's a good little actor. And he can be a worm that way. You know, he'll say, "Oh, yes, sir, I understand fully," and he doesn't. So you have to know when it's going on. And as I recall, we had some of that sort of situation with him.
Right, right. Wow. Matt, anything else before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, Dale, have you got any plans to write a memoir? Because you've had this incredible career, not only a military career, but also in filmmaking as well. That's got to be. And you're a... prolific writer yourself. You've written a number of books. Have you got any, you know, plans to write a memoir about your experiences?
I'll tell you what the answer is. I have written it.
Oh, wow.
And it's in two books. It's called The Art of War and War is Art. So one covers my personal military experience and then my experience in films. The question right now is, when are they going to release it? I think my wife is holding out to wait for me to kick the bucket, and then she'll release it and make a whole lot more money or something.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding. I don't know. I run a publishing company called Warriors Publishing, and that's a subsidiary of my Warriors Advisory Services. So I think at some point, probably in the next year or two, I will probably release it, and we'll see what happens.
Oh, wow. We look forward to reading that. So interesting.
Well, give yourself some time. It's pretty thick.
Oh, well, yeah. I'm sure I can find a lot of washing up to do to listen to it while I'm doing it. So maybe on that, Matt, I think that might be all the time we have today.
I think so. Thank you so much for joining us, Dale. I mean, it's been an incredible conversation.
It's absolute fun to talk to, you know, I'm talking to kindred spirits here.
Oh, thank you. Means a lot.
You guys know exactly what I'm talking about. We could do this without words, I think, for the most part. But
yeah.
But you've got a great site. I took a look at it.
Thank you.
And I'm gonna poke through and hear some of your previous interviews, because I really enjoyed this. It's fun.
Oh, thank you so much. And we just know that our listeners will love this. So another huge thank you to Dale Dye for joining us today. It's been a monumentous episode. It's been fascinating to hear tales from the sets of war movies for the last 40-odd years. And a thank you again, Dale, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Guys, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And don't forget, you can listen to the rest of the Fighting on Film back catalogue on our website, fightingonfilm.com. And we'll catch you next week for more war movie reviews. Bye-bye, everyone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.